Good evening, everybody, and thank you for staying the course. In a few minutes, I'm going to introduce Abe Fuchs to MC the rest of the evening. But before I do, I have to administer the final exam in this course. It's a real incident that took place on the West Island of Montreal in the 1990s, and the public health people were called in to figure it out. And I'm going to ask you guys tonight to do the same thing, and there's a small prize for the person who solved the mystery, the McDonald's mystery. By the way, this is the Mini-Med series. There's a competing series across the hall. And I think it's nutrition and cancer. So if you're in the right place, that's fine. If you're looking for the other one, go ahead, and it's over there. So the incident is this. A team of young hockey players went to McDonald's on a Saturday morning after their Saturday morning game. But to the consternation of the McDonald's staff, several of them started to get sick at McDonald's, something almost unheard of. And your job is to figure out what it was that made them sick. And to speed things up, I'd like to make it a formal 20 questions type of thing. You ask me something, I'll give you an answer. We need to get this done in 5 minutes. We can't be here all 20. So away you go. So that's all I'm going to tell you to start with. If you know right away what this is, please leave some fun for the others and don't say, or say very lightly or less lowly. So any questions? These young hockey players got sick. Sorry?
In the meat?
No. Is the fact that hockey player is relevant? Why do you think I mentioned it? You could ask a question, but it can be in the form of a very direct answer if you want.
Perhaps subjected to some
trauma?
No, CO poisoning?
Wait. Why would you say that? Let's move out of McDonald's first. What were the other obvious questions for McDonald's before we move to where you were talking about? Yes, but please don't. Not everybody heard that, right? Did everybody hear what he said? No. Okay, and some of they did. They didn't catch it all. So let's stay out with McDonald's for a few more minutes, a few more seconds. What should be the next question? He got there too fast, but what should be the next question? Did the parents get sick? No, none of the parents got sick.
Were they there?
They were at the hockey game, and they were at McDonald's, yes. Sorry? About 8 or 9, something like that. About this high, which is relevant as well. Yeah, but why can we eliminate McDonald's first? We need to eliminate McDonald's. None of the parents got sick. Some got sick even before their food had arrived. Okay, so now we move back to the hockey rink. What?
Chlorine. Poisoning from the ice.
Yeah, what?
Chlorine.
Not chlorine. Not the water bottles that they share. The parents didn't get sick. The other team did get sick. The referee didn't get sick. Exhaust from the Zamboni machine. Who said that? I think this man at the very beginning said it. And they skate right into it at about this height. And that's where the referee didn't get sick either. They did. But they didn't go to McDonald's. So it wasn't an outbreak. So I think this man, do you either want to come down and get your gift, the very first man who said CO, or we'll bring our doctor, Gilles Paradis, will bring it up to you if you like, your gift. That's your job. So he is going to come down. Give him one, ask him which one he'd prefer, and then... The other one, it's not fixed, no. Who is next? I heard it from somebody else.
Over here. Come on down.
And thank you. Yeah, this is the book that Dr. Wyvan mentioned, The Origin of AIDS, which is a good read. Yeah. The other one was The Ghost Map by Stephen Johnson. So, Gilles, while you're here, I'd like you to... sorry, the Mini-Med people I'd like to... Are any of them around? The Mini-Med organizers. Are they, how many of them are where? Kathy, I told them that we would have something for them. Yeah, because really, we want to give them a small little gift just to say that they, for their courage, as much as anything else, in signing up this department for the entire series, which was a big risk, and for trusting us that we could make it interesting for you guys for a whole season. Somewhere here there should be a gift.
That's a very nice bag.
Yeah, here's the, there's a gift in there. This is for the whole Mini-Med team. Okay, whoever wants to take it, and you'll have to fight about how to work it. I see Ibi on our way down. Ibi, you'll have to make the rules as to how it's going to get shared. So now, thank you, Ibi, and thank you the whole team. So now I'll turn it over to Dr. Fuchs for the rest of the evening.
Jim, thank you very much. I'm delighted to meet you all again. I'm Abe Fuchs from the Faculty of Medicine. As usual, we need a roll call. How many students from CJEP or high schools? Pick up a hand. Fantastic. We're delighted you're here. Part of the reason that we have the series is to bring you here, bring you onto the campus, tell you about education in the health professions, about science, epidemiology, medicine, nursing, physio, OT, speech pathology, and more. So we're very, very pleased that you're here. One of the problems for the case that Dr. Hanley told you about is there is no good diagnostic test for Zamboni sickness. So today we're going to learn about diagnostic tests. You always say, well, we're going to do a test, we'll do an X-ray. But there's a lot behind the science of tests and testing. How do you develop a test? What's a good test? How do you disseminate it? Does every test have to be done by a doctor or a clinic or a lab? Can you do a test at home? So we're really delighted tonight that we're going to hear about two sets of diagnostic tests in two different spheres. All of them have to do with health, communities, health in the world, so-called global health. And we have a treat for you tonight. I think this is the first time in my recollection, Cappy will help me, where we have a husband and wife team presenting. So both of them talking about the science and their daughter, who is also here. So that's a triple header, and we're really delighted to have you with us. We have Dr. Nikita Pai and Dr. Madhu Pai. Nikita will start first. She's a member of the Department of Medicine and the Research Institute at the MUHC. She's a physician who also got a degree in epidemiology at the University of California, Berkeley. She was recruited here, the two of them together, to McGill. And her interest is diagnostic tests for two major groups of illnesses. Hepatitis is one, HIV is the other. And you'll hear how the two go together and how that causes challenges for epidemiologists and physicians. Those of you who've always thought about epidemiology as simply counting how many cases of X or Y or Z, this is a very different but related kind of epidemiology, which tries to determine what tests are good, which ones are better, and how do we get them out to the population. Her work, both in communities, special needs populations, pregnant women, and so on, both for sexually transmitted diseases and a whole host of other viral diseases, has been supported by work from the Canadian Institute for Health Research that awarded her a new investigator grant. She's funded by the Melinda and Bill Gates Foundation, has won many awards as a Canada Stars in Global Health twice, 2011 and 2013, and has a very interesting array of tests that's been supported by PLOS, which is an important series of journals, the Wellcome Trust, a charity and an important one in England, and Google, that you've all heard about. So we'll hear a lot more about that and her wonderful achievements that's led to all these awards and support. Madhu Pai did his medical training in his native India, also came to the United States, and also did a degree in epidemiology at the University of California, Berkeley. Did a postdoctoral fellowship at another very special institution, UCSF, University of California, San Francisco, and then both of them came to a very special institution, namely McGill. Dr. Pai is now an associate professor in the Department of Medicine. He's also the associate director of the McGill International TB Center, and we'll hear more about that. There are many of you, some of you in the audience, who remember the little signs on streetcars in blue and white that say, "Don't spit." Alan remembers it. Some of the older folks will remember. Alan never took the streetcar, but in any case, suddenly those signs disappear and we think TB disappears, but you learn and hear that one-third of the world's population carries the TB bacterium. They're not sick, but they're carriers, and we'll learn more about that. So his work as well is supported by the Gates Foundation. He's also a member of the Scientific Advisory Committee on Innovative New Diagnostics, which is what you'll hear about in Geneva. He is on the editorial boards of multiple journals and very prestigious ones, The Lancet Infectious Disease, the International Journal of TB and Lung Disease, and many others. Despite his youth, he's already published more than 200 peer-reviewed papers, which is quite an accomplishment. Again, has awards from Grand Challenges Canada and support. He's the recipient of the Union Scientific Prize, the Stars in Global Health Award with Nikita, and also this year was one of the founding nominees, successfully, to the Junior Academy of the Royal Society of Canada, also a very prestigious honor. So why all the honors? We're about to hear. Nikita, I think you're going first.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for that wonderful introduction, Dr. Fuchs. This is our first talk as a couple. You wouldn't want to know what two epidemiologists do when they get into the car. They discuss and they argue. Today I'm going to talk about something that is very close to our hearts. And it's basically diagnostics and the process of diagnosis. So the process of diagnosis, can anybody define that for me? What is diagnosing? We have students in the audience. We have a very educated audience that can figure out carbon monoxide poisoning. So what do you think is diagnosis? Right, there's root cause of illness. And how do we do that?
Through tests, through examinations.
So that's what it is. So the process of diagnosis is trying to find the cause and the effect of any phenomena. In the medical field, it is trying to find the cause of any illness. And there are certain ways in which we as physicians go about it. So we do history, we do physical examination, and we use diagnostic tests and procedures. And in instances where it is not easy to really find it through these three elementary steps, we try and use this process of pattern recognition, we use clinical algorithms, we use a process called differential diagnosis, we exclude, we find the diagnosis by excluding certain conditions, and we also use certain criteria. Today we're going to exclusively focus on diagnostic tests. And the reason why diagnostic tests are important is because, as you can see, I have certain gadgets in my hand. I have a point of care test. This is a test This is a test that is used at the patient bedside in West Africa, East Africa, to stage patients into care at the point of clinical contact. And you can get results within 20 minutes. How cool is that? So what you can do is, with these kind of tests that look really simple, but they're simply complicated, you can get a result, you can avoid sending samples to the lab, and you can get results as accurate as, you know, the sensitivity is as high as 99%. The specificity is as high as 100%. So we've looked at all the evidence, and we can say that. I have certain other things here. Is anybody into Fitbits? What is this? Does anybody know what this is? Have you been using it? How many in the audience are using Fitbits? No idea. So this is like, this has a tracker built in. It's like a pedometer slash tracker. So if you open it, it has a little sensor attached to it here. And this can actually measure the, I'm not doing an infomercial here, but it can actually measure the number of steps that you've taken. And for people like ourselves who usually sit at home and sit at the offices and don't exercise much, it's a good indicator of trying to find out how many step counts you've taken. So you can set it up for 5,000 step counts or 10,000 step counts. So that's that. And then I have a phone here. How do you think this phone can be used for diagnosing? So imagine, turn on your right brains, 5 to 10 years from now, if we are alive, we'll give a new lecture. We'll have, most of the diagnosis is going to be done with the smartphones, even at McGill. And most of the diagnosis in developing countries is also going to be done with the smartphones. What a good equalizer is that. So anyways, let's walk you through what's going to happen in the next 10 to 20 minutes. So the reason why early and rapid diagnosis is important is because it reduces morbidity. It saves costs to the healthcare system. So there are different kinds of tests. There are screening tests, there are diagnostic tests, there are prognostic tests, right? And these tests are used for various different conditions. You can use them to identify risk factors. You can use them to predict how a patient is going to respond. You can use them to monitor therapy over time. You can use them to just change behaviors or influence behaviors. And you can also use them for something called personalized medicine, where you actually are not going to use your clinical intuition, which we used a lot in the past, but we're going to use it for, it's going to become even more precise. So let's take a look back at the history of medicine and see the kinds of diagnostic tools we had. So in 1632 to 1723, Antony van Leeuwenhoek developed the first microscope, right? And this microscope is used even today, right? And then there comes the stethoscope. Stethoscope was developed by René Laennec. We also have this brand as Laennec's stethoscope. And if you imagine using the stethoscope, sometimes if you are asked to distinguish between a heart murmur due to atrial stenosis or atrial regurgitation or mitral stenosis and atrial stenosis, sometimes it is really hard to figure out, right? You may pretend to know a heart murmur. But now with smartphones, the process has become very easy. Then we have the X-rays that came along. And today, as you know, thanks to genomic sequencing, we have tests that can actually, with $200, you can actually find out what conditions you have. You can trace your ancestry. You can find out whether you're going to respond to certain drugs and whether you have certain traits, whether you are at risk for breast cancer or Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. We'll talk about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, but the good thing is that you're able to find out where you come from, what are your risk factors, what is the probability of you developing these certain conditions that you worry about over your lifetime, and what you can do with that information. Imagine this stethoscope. So we showed you a picture of the old stethoscope that Laennec invented, and look at this one that comes with a smartphone. How cool is that? In real time, you can actually get EKG, it's an echo and an EKG combined into one. So you can actually get to more precise diagnosing with this kind of an instrument. So these innovations are now in the pipeline. A lot of innovations are on their way. In the olden days, tests for TB. TB used to be diagnosed with culture using a microscope. goes, the test went to the lab in different, in many parts of the world, especially in Asia and Africa. It still takes about 3 weeks to 8 weeks to 2 months to 3 months to get a test result. But with a GeneXpert rapid test, a point of care test, you can get your test result to your patient back in a turnaround time of 2 hours. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I think it's fantastic for the patient to know. GeneXpert can also detect resistance to TB drugs. So you can not only know that the patient that you're seeing has TB for sure, you can also stage the patient and find out which drugs he's going to be responding to, so you can make a personalized plan for treatment for your patient. And if you can do all of that within one patient visit, you not only save time for your patient, but also for your healthcare system. So these tests are now being, a lot of them are being funded, a lot of them are being promoted by foundations like the Gates Foundation, the Clinton Health Access Initiative. They are all trying to bring down the prices of these tests so that a lot more people can get screened and staged into care early on. And then comes, there's another test for, so HIV testing has come a long way. For the past 2.5 decades, we had the old lab-based tests. They were called ELISAs and Western blot. And with ELISAs and Western blot, you can get results from the lab, depends on the lab and depends on the setting that you work. You can get results within 2 weeks to 4 weeks to 2 months. It just depends on where you're located. So what happens with that long turnaround time? With the long turnaround time, you typically lose your patients. Some patients do not come back for a follow-up visit. So therein comes the role of point-of-care tests. These point-of-care tests, like the one that you see with this girl putting, using this oral swab test, these oral tests tap onto the saliva. They detect HIV antibodies using a patient's saliva, and you can get result as early as 20 minutes. And what is the accuracy of these tests? They are as accurate as they are 98 to 99% sensitive and 99.6 to 99.9% specific. So in settings where you have a huge burden of HIV, like South Africa, these tests are as good as, you know, you can just use one test if you have a patient that has risk factors and is suspecting a recent exposure. You can actually stage patients. And if the test is positive, you can be certain that the person has HIV. So you can minimize the time it takes to stage a patient and you can get him into care early on. So that's the power of rapid diagnosing. You can save a lot of time and money. And with these tests, you can also, in recent times, you can also take them home and you can test them at home. So home self-tests have also become really popular. In the U.S., the U.S. FDA in 2012 approved a home-based test. This home-based test can give you a result in 20 to 40 minutes. In 20 minutes, you should wait ideally till 40 minutes, but you can get your test result within 20 minutes. And then you can call to get counseling. So these tests are also have made it so easy for us to actually know our serostatus. How about ultrasound? So ultrasound has also made that transition from being an equipment that was used by specialists to one that is used by family physicians. How about this mobile smartphone that could be used to detect anemia from just examining the patient's conjunctiva? We are going to be using one of these smartphone-based tests in a new study in India, and we are looking forward to detecting anemia in pregnant women, in rural pregnant women, using just a simple smartphone-based test. These tests are really precise, so based on the result of or the results that you get, you can actually treat patients. Some innovators have come up with smartphone-based sensors that can actually pick up heart rate, and they can help triage infants who develop pneumonia. Pneumonia is one of the single biggest killers of infants worldwide. Let's talk about a tablet. So a new tablet called Swasthya Slate Health Tablet is being developed in India, and this tablet is like an iPad. It's basically a small-sized Android tablet that has several apps and sensors, and it can pick up 33 conditions. It can be used to stage your blood pressure, find your blood pressure, pick up blood glucose, run a lot of tests, a host of tests, including HIV and syphilis. And this is now being used in communities where you have fewer doctors. So it's almost become like a companion to a physician or to a frontline healthcare professionals. So these things are, there's this, the pace of innovation in diagnostics is so rapid that the science is struggling to keep pace with it. Has anybody heard about something called Omware? Yeah? Could you talk about it? Where are you? Yes. Fantastic. He works in the company. So Omware is a Montreal-based company, and it was set up by a surgeon. I think the person behind it, the brain behind it, is a surgeon, is a rotator cuff surgeon. And these are like wearables. So wearables that come with trackers, they can track your heart rate, your calorie consumption. They can also give you a baseline heart rate. They can act as a pedometer. They have sensors built in. So you can basically, in real time, and they can also, I think they are also working to add sleep patterns. So in real time, you can actually find out how many steps you've walked, how many calories you've burnt, and all that information, I think, can be wirelessly connected, can be backed up, and also be communicated to your physician. Why is that useful? Well, in future, when we are trying to make an effort to improving our lifestyles and getting more fit, we can provide our physicians with a personalized scan, a report of what we've been up to. So it's great for people who are getting onto fitness programs because the fitness experts and trainers don't know. They give you recommendations, but they don't know whether you've been acting on them. So most of these wearable health technologies are now becoming very popular. There's the iWatch. How many of us have heard of the iWatch? So the iWatch can pretty much do a lot of stuff. So the Fitbit will probably be replaced by the iWatch. So we have a lot of innovations. Then there is this other innovation which gives you a real-time glucose monitoring. How cool is that? For patients who are diabetic, it's extremely important to look at the patterns. So now I think we've really come to the point where we are really ready for the tricorder. I was a big fan of Star Trek when I grew up. I grew up in India, so I was a big fan of Star Trek. And I didn't know that I would land up in Montreal because I used to be a big fan of William Shatner. We used to swoon, all the girls, we used to swoon when William Shatner would come on stage. And so when I landed here and he was there for just for laughs, it was almost like, you know, you see, it's like my daughter when she goes to Disneyland and sees Mickey Mouse and starts jumping. I just saw him and I started jumping and I didn't know that he lived in NDG. We used to, and of course Spock. Spock used always, did you remember how he used to carry this tricorder? He could scan you. So tricorder is an all-encompassing device. It includes a scanner, it includes a sensor, and it includes a recorder. So it will be able to diagnose multiple conditions by just scanning you. I don't know what the process of scanning we probably wouldn't be happy with, but then isn't it fantastic to have something like this? So Qualcomm a few years ago announced this XPRIZE, and they had a call. They put out a call out there, a $10 million prize, and invited people to submit their applications, and they've chosen a few companies to develop this tricorder. And I think a British company had already developed in 2008 something that is similar to a tricorder, but now I think they've tried to push the bar and they want to incorporate a lot of other things like DNA tests also into it. This is our innovation. We developed an innovation. We developed an HIV smart strategy. This HIV smart strategy can allow anybody in any part of the world, to understand the process of diagnosis and to stage themselves into care. And how does that work? So as we know, for HIV, we've had conventional testing and counseling strategies, lab-based testing and counseling strategies for a long time. But they've failed to bring people into care because people in all parts of the world, whether it's Canada, US, the number of people living with undiagnosed HIV in North America is about 25%. In UK, it's 20%. In Africa, it's about 50%. 50% people do not know their serostatus. Why is that important? The reason why that is important is that because in today's day and age, we have a lot of money for treatment, and we have treatment that is available in African countries. So if we are to reverse the tide of the HIV epidemic, we need to get people into care. And if people don't want to show up in healthcare facilities, we need to go back to the people. So therein comes the role of self-testing, which can overcome all these barriers of stigma, discrimination, social embarrassment of getting tested in public facilities, fear of loss of lack of confidentiality, and judgmental attitudes. So the need is very obvious. There's a need for confidential, anonymized, personalized self-testing strategy that can allow for easy linkages, easy conduct, and can save time and money. So our app allows somebody who wishes to get tested, it walks them through the process of testing. It actually can be customized to any self-test on the market. Currently, it's customized to the only test that is available that's approved by the FDA. And it basically teaches somebody who wishes to self-test as to how to go about it, what to do with it, how to conduct a test, what to do, where to go for linkages to counseling, where to contact physicians, how to locate a physician. It is a comprehensive strategy. You can also interpret your result. You can store your result. You can find out where the nearest provider is. We are trying to customize this app for Canada. We are reverse innovating it for Montreal. We got a CIHR grant to do that, and we are also waiting to scale it up in Africa. We've tested it out in several different populations. We've tested it out in healthcare professionals. We also started out by testing it out in students at McGill University, and now we're trying to see if we can take it to scale in African countries. So I hope you're convinced that this is a very exciting time in the next 5 to 10 years. We are going to enter a new world of rapid diagnosing. Various gadgets are going to be used. A lot of industries are in this, and a lot of big industries like Google, Apple, they are getting into health, into the space of health. And so all our data is going to be personalized, available real time. It'll be connected from your mobile to your doctor's laptop. And everything is going to be at point of clinical care. So this is the world of big data. Yes, there are issues that we need to resolve. But, you know, all our data like social, medical, genetic, you know, daily caloric intake, daily sleep, vital signs, step count, all of that is going to be available in real time. The idea and the ideal is that it should be anonymized and our confidentiality would be protected. So U.S. has taken steps to protect confidentiality on that front. But all the data from smartware to Fitbits, from genomic testing, all of that could be integrated on the cloud. We are also using a technology that can allow, we're developing a couple of other applications that can allow multiple testing of several infections, like for HIV, HIV-related co-infections like hepatitis, hepatitis B, C, syphilis, anemia. We're trying to integrate testing all of that in pregnant women by frontline healthcare professionals in India. And so what is all of this big data for? This big data is to help develop a personalized plan for health promotion, for wellness, for diagnosing, for targeted medication intake, for better monitoring, and for better management. I think I'm very optimistic about this, but then there's a little bit of skepticism, and my other half is going to talk about the skepticism.
Hi, I'm the other half, as you can see. I always follow. I never leave. So you can already see, if you are not excited and jazzed up about diagnostics, that I live with a techie, right? I don't know why she went into med school. She could have easily gone and started a startup company in Silicon Valley. In fact, we were across the bay from the Silicon Valley. I told her to go and join Apple or Google. We would be getting paid much more than we are today, Nikki. I'm looking at Dean Eidelman here. So she is such a techie that one time, I kid you not, she told me she's going to put a microchip into me so that she can monitor where I'm going. Talk about privacy and confidentiality, right? Doesn't even exist. Now she wants me to go and get underpants that can monitor my blood pressure. They exist. Okay, there's a company out there making a wearable underwear that can monitor your blood pressure. Very, very exciting. So, I don't know. But to be honest, I'm also into diagnostic research. I've spent the last 20 years of my life trying to improve the diagnosis of tuberculosis. But I'm also an epidemiologist, right? So all I want to convey to you in the next segment of the talk is that this is exciting, but let's be thoughtful about what these tests can or cannot do. How many of you have walked through one of those crazy scanning machines at the airport and it beep, it went, right? So is that technology perfect? Yes or no? You know how much they cost? Millions of dollars, right? And yet, they produce errors, don't they? So that just goes to tell you that every test, no matter what it is, how fancy it is, has inbuilt error in it. As patients, as consumers, we need to really understand them much better. And we certainly need to understand them as doctors, okay? I wear a Fitbit too, can you see? And I know it has an inbuilt error, but I need to know how to exploit that technology. So my job is to now tell you how we as clinical epidemiologists think about diagnostic tests, how we trial them, how we tend to use them in clinical practice. Let me give you another example. I just came through the airport yesterday from India, and I was asked questions about Ebola. Has that happened to you yet? Yes? Have you gone here? Have you gone to Africa? And in some airports, they're testing people for Ebola. Using what? A thermometer. Now, if you are a kid with viral infection, good luck to you, right? You don't even have to be a kid. How many different diseases can cause fever? So is that specific to Ebola? So the word specificity has a clear meaning. Nikki used the term sensitivity and specificity. She didn't define them, but I will, so that we start trying to understand what these terminologies mean. So how do we know that anything my wife said is good, accurate, or useful, right? So this is exactly why you need clinical epidemiologists. She is also a clinical epidemiologist, so am I, okay? Diagnostic tests, believe me, folks, are just like drugs or vaccines. Just because it's on the market doesn't mean it's good for you, okay? You have to really work hard to understand what its scope is, what its clinical utility is, when it can produce good results, and when it can be outright misleading. There are tests that are on the market that should not be on the market. And I know, I have tried very hard to get rid of some of them because they're not good, because I think it's dangerous for patients, okay? So just like that drug trials, we need to do diagnostic trials. All of you know what it takes for a drug to go on the market? Phase one clinical trial, right? Jim and others have spoken to you about randomized trials. Same for vaccine, remember? The SARC trial that Jim spoke about. All of those need to be thought through for diagnostic tests as well. So before I begin telling you how we validate diagnostic tests and figure out whether they work or not, I want to tell you a fundamental difference between diagnostic tests and screening tests, right? Can any of you tell me what is a mammogram that women undergo every year or every second year? Is it a diagnostic test or a screening test? Screening test. What do men get when they are old for prostate cancer? PSA or a rectal examination, right? That's also a screening test. So screening tests are done on apparently healthy people, right? You're not sick, you're not seeking care usually, right? They recommend that you undergo screening so that if you have an early disease, that can be picked up, okay? Diagnostic test, on the other hand, is when the patient comes knocking at the doctor's office. The doc, I'm not well, right? So the scenarios are completely different. In our thinking, the pretest probability or likelihood of disease is very high in one and very, very low in another scenario. Does that make sense? When is it high? Diagnostic or screening situation? Diagnostic. Screening situation, every disease is rare. the prevalence of disease in a screening context is very, very low. Keep that at the back of your mind, because the importance or the utility of a test can dramatically change depending on whether somebody is sick or if somebody is really healthy and you're doing a screening test on them, okay? Completely different scenarios. So, diagnosis, as Nikki mentioned, she told you about pattern recognition, right? That's a well-known pattern recognition, but most of the time, doctors cannot necessarily use pattern recognition. Sometimes it's very, very easy and straightforward. Have you ever seen a child with scabies? Good for you. I've seen a lot of them in India, okay? It takes me 2 seconds to diagnose scabies on a kid. That's pattern recognition, okay? Very easy to do, not complicated. Most people don't need any diagnostic testing. But rest of the time, somebody walks in with fever. I have no idea what the cause of the fever is. The doctor typically goes through a series of probabilities in his or her mind, okay? So here is one way of thinking about probabilities, okay? So, if the probability, the scale is slightly off, but 100% is on the other end, okay? Just mentally realign that. So, 0% means you really do not have that disease, okay? 100% means you absolutely have that condition that we are looking for. And anywhere in between is the probability, okay? So, in general, if you want to be absolutely sure that you have the disease, you want to confirm it close to 100% as possible, yes? And for really, really serious conditions like cancer, you have to get that at 100%, right? You can't put someone through chemotherapy or radiotherapy if you're not sure that they really have cancer or not, yes? There are conditions when we're not that rigid. We're willing to accept the diagnosis even at the 80% level, okay? So in our minds, there are two thresholds. They're fuzzy, they're not necessarily well-defined. But there is a threshold here. Let me point it out for you. Okay, this threshold is a threshold to even test. If the probability of disease is so low, 5%, 10%, should we even be testing for that disease? We say, let that be alone. We're not going to go looking for it. Okay, and there is a threshold here, which is fairly high, where beyond that, again, testing is irrelevant. Because the probability is so high, I might as well treat. I don't need to mess around anymore with testing. Once I've reached that high level of threshold, I've made up my mind, I'm just going to treat you. A good diagnostic is one which helps you make the transition from somewhere here to above the treatment threshold. Okay? Or it can take you from the middle and push you under the test threshold. Either it needs to lift you up and push your probability so high that I'm ready to treat you, or it's going to push me so low that I'm going to say, you know what, you don't have cancer, go home. One way or the other, that's a good diagnostic test. The worst diagnostic test is where I begin with a probability somewhere here, and even after the test, I'm still there. Right? I'm still confused as hell. I don't know what to do with my patient anymore. Okay? That's a test that hasn't given enough information in it to help me push over treatment threshold, push me under the test threshold. So, in an ideal world, a diagnostic test would look like this. Everyone with the disease will absolutely have a certain value on the test, and everybody without the disease will absolutely not have that. Right? Perfect black and white scenario. You have cancer, everybody will light up positive on the test. You do not have cancer, not a single person will light up on that test. Does this test exist? Yes? No? Absolutely not. I haven't seen one, okay? So, the problem is, reality is like this. Can you see an overlap of the two curves? So let's say, how many of you know about a disease called glaucoma? Yes? How does the optometrist or the doctor test for it? Have you had it tested? Your intraocular pressure? If you took the intraocular pressure of people with glaucoma and normal eyes, people do not, you will find a big overlap between them. So it's not an absolute threshold. Depending on where you move the cutoff, you could misclassify some people without glaucoma as having glaucoma and glaucoma as having no glaucoma. This is true for everything. Cholesterol, blood pressure, C-reactive protein, TSA, you name it, you will find an overlap between disease and non-disease people. This creates a nightmare for doctors. Where do I draw the cutoff? And if I change the cutoff a little bit, what's going to happen? Right? And remember, the threshold for diabetes has been dropping and dropping and dropping over time? Right? Soon, everybody will be diabetic and hypertensive. You might as well put statins in the drinking water. Okay? That's what the world is going to. Whether it's good or not, it's important to keep in mind that thresholds change over a history. Right? When Professor Fuchs was in medical school, what was the threshold of Dean Fuchs for blood pressure, hypertension? 140, 90 could not have been the case. Right? It would have been much higher than that. Right? Keeps changing over time, and diabetes cutoff has steadily dropped over the years. Okay? So this is really important for us to know. Cutoffs matter a lot. Especially cut tests that produce a continuous number rather than a yes or no result. Can you folks give me examples of tests that produce a number rather than a result? Cholesterol. What else? PSA. Blood sugar. Right? Creatinine. What else?
Blood pressure.
They all produce continuous numbers. Can you give me tests that produce a yes or no result? Huh? Pregnancy. Okay? What else? That better be a yes or no, okay? You don't want anything in between. What else? Strep for throat infection. Okay? What else? Amniocentesis for Down syndrome or congenital anomalies. Okay. So, cut points, keep in mind, are always a compromise. Okay? By changing the cut point, you can deliberately choose to make a test more sensitive at the cost of specificity. And I'll explain to you what that really means. Okay? So cutoffs are important. Without a cutoff, most tests are uninterpretable. Okay? So there's no point in just giving you a value unless you know what cutoff goes with it. And cutoffs, same test can produce different results depending on what threshold I choose. Right? So I can say your cholesterol is high. If I change the cutoff, then that would also change on how many people are found to have high cholesterol. Cutoffs change over time. So there is no perfect test, and all tests have inbuilt error in them. This is a classic problem in medicine or science that we call decision-making under uncertainty. You know who this is? This is Reverend Thomas Bayes. Biostatisticians love Bayes. Okay? So there's a whole field in biostatistics called Bayesian biostatistics. Okay? In fact, biostatisticians get all angst about this Bayesian thing. Some people say, I'm a Bayesian. Others say, I won't even talk to you if you're a Bayesian. Okay? They can fight with each other. But anyway, this Reverend Thomas Bayes wrote this very seminal essay towards solving a problem in the doctrine of chance. And the way he formulated the Bayesian theory is that everything is a play of probability, right? You take the information that you know, and you add more information to what you know, and then you revise the probability to something else, okay? It's a cumulative, iterative process, and I like that a lot. I think fundamentally diagnosis is a Bayesian phenomenon. You begin with some information, and you change, get some new information, and then you revise your probability on whether somebody has a disease or doesn't have a disease. Okay? I love the way how somebody formulated this. There is a complex formula for Bayesian, but Jim Manley can tell you I'm not interested in that. Okay? I'll tell you my favorite way of what you thought before plus new information equals to what you think now. That's Bayesian theory for you in simple English. Okay? So, what you thought before, the biostatisticians will call it pre-test probability. Before I even test you, I already have some probability in my head on whether you have the disease or not. Then I test you, the test result comes back, whatever the test is, right? That test has its intrinsic sensitivity and specificity, which combined together, we call that a likelihood ratio. A likelihood ratio, think of it as a lift. A good test will have a big likelihood ratio to push you from here to a very high probability, or push you from high to a very low probability. It will help you rule in the disease, or it will help you rule out the disease. That's a good test. If the likelihood ratio is 1, no matter what you multiply it with, you're still left with the same number. That's a bad test, which means adding the test hasn't quite shifted your probabilities either up or down. That's not a good situation to be in. So we take the test, pre-test probability, we do the test, and we get the post-test probability. That is, after the test, here is my revised probability on whether you have the disease or you don't have the disease. Does that make sense? Yes? Now we're going to walk through examples, okay? So a good test is one, as I mentioned, which will take you from a low pre-test probability. Let's say you have a 20% chance of having cancer. Once a test result comes, you have a pretty large post-test probability. Now you have a 90% chance of having a cancer. Okay? So it has moved you up along the scale, quite a lift, and that's a good test. This scenario is equally acceptable to us. It goes you from a fairly high pre-test probability, test result comes back, pushes the probability so low that it's very nice to tell a patient, you know what, you really don't have cancer. That's a great diagnosis. Yes? You ruled out the disease, you sent somebody home. Or you tell a mom, you know what, your baby does not have Down syndrome. Go home, right? That's also a good situation to be in. Bad test is one where even after the test, the clinician is stuck at the same place that he or she started with. So how do you even get this test properties? Remember I told you the likelihood ratio, sensitivity, specificity? How do you even get this information? Well, you have to first do a diagnostic study. Okay? Let's say you have one of Nikki's favorite gadgets. What's this thing? Okay, whatever it is. Okay? I don't even know what she does. But anyway, let's say it's this fancy device that she's been throwing around. Okay? I don't know how good this is. It's an HIV test. Okay? So what do we need to do? We have to first come up with this diagnostic study where we compare this new test against an established gold standard. Okay? Sometimes there's no gold standard, so we'll use a silver standard. Okay? We'll take whatever is best standard in clinical medicine as of 2014, and everybody in the study will get this, as well as the gold standard test performed simultaneously on all the same patients. Is that okay? Once we do that, we know what we compare this against. We compare the performance of the new test against the gold standard, and we compute some simple probability numbers like sensitivity and specificity. Okay? Now, I was warned not to hit you folks with numbers, but you know what? If I understand these numbers, so can you. I went into medicine because I couldn't handle math. Okay? So I assure you, this is going to be easy. Okay? If I'm teaching this, you totally can nail this. Okay? So this is a diagnostic 2x2 table. Jim has shown you the 2x2 table that epidemiologists use. Typically, this is how we look at it. You see here, disease positive, disease negative. And that is from the perspective of the gold standard. The gold standard helps classify everybody into the study into diseased and non-diseased. Why do we rely on the gold standard? Because that's the best test we have. Okay? Then, this is test positive, test negative. And that's this. Whatever test you're evaluating is on this axis, the gold standard is on the top axis. Everybody in the study will fall in one of the four cells. Cell A, B, C, D, everybody will fall into them, okay? So if you are here, you're positive on the test, and you have the disease. Is that okay? That cell is called true positive. Very easy to understand. If you are in this cell, you do not have the disease, and you're negative on the test, that is a true negative. Now, imagine if this test were really as good as what my wife said. Which cell will people fall into? If it was a perfect test, which cell will people fall into? Either here or here. There should be nobody on these diagonal cells, correct? The diagonal cells are the headache cells. That's where error is, okay? Here is someone who does not truly have the disease, but the test is lighting up as positive. What do we call them? False positive result. Can it happen? It absolutely can happen. When you went through that airport scanner and it went bleep, that's a false positive. Okay? And if you have a gun and you walk through the scanner, that's a false negative. It missed somebody with a gun. That's a false negative result. Okay? Simplistically, that's how we collect the data. Okay? Now, let's walk you through some examples. Before I do that, I'll explain four simple probabilities. Jim will call these conditional probabilities. Conditional on something being fixed, what is the probability of something happening? Okay? So I'm going to first condition on the disease being present. Can you see that? If I add up everybody in that column, everybody is positive on the gold standard. That entire column is that people with the disease according to the gold standard. Is that okay? Fixing on disease truly being there, what percentage of the time is the test also positive? So that's this cell divided by the total number of people with the disease. So true positive divided by everybody who has a disease, that simple percentage, 80%, 90%, is called sensitivity of the test. Sensitivity of the test means among all those with the disease, what percent is picked up by your test that you're testing. Is that okay? If this is really good, sensitivity should be 100%. Okay? If it is 50%, it's as good as tossing a coin. I think it's that. Okay? All right. She's not going to give me any food tonight. Okay? All right. Specificity. Okay? That's the second property. Sensitivity alone is not sufficient. You also need to understand specificity. Among all those without the disease, as per the gold standard, how many are declared as negative on the test is called specificity. Okay? So if you do not have the disease, should this light up? No. Everybody should be negative on this. That's specificity. So you would like the specificity to be how much in an ideal test? 100. Okay? You do not want anyone who's false positive. Okay? Predictive value of a positive test is really important for all of you folks to understand, particularly from the patient's perspective. Why is that? In reality, nobody has a gold standard. Gold standard is usually an expensive test, an invasive test. Very often, all we have is a basic test that is used in medicine. So let's say this is your PSA result. Does the PSA automatically mean you have prostate cancer? No, right? It's just a screening test or a tool that is being used. So now you have a problem. The PSA result is in your hands. You have to work your way backwards and say, if my test is positive, what is the likelihood of truly having prostate cancer? Does that make sense? This is the opposite of saying, among people with prostate cancer, how many have an abnormal PSA? Okay? Now I'm starting to interpret the data from the perspective of the test. So I'm saying, I'm going to say, among all those who are test positive on this one, how many truly have the disease? Okay? This is called predictive value of a positive test. Then I have its counterpart called predictive value of a negative test. Among all those who are negative on this test, how many are truly non-diseased according to the gold standard? These are the four numbers that we compute automatically from a 2x2 table. Okay? Now, I'm going to give the same thing to you in a visual illustration. Some people do not like formula and math. This is for you. Okay? So imagine a world where there's all these people with white circles. White circle means you do not have the disease. Black circle means you have the disease. Is that okay? So that's a population. Some people have disease. Most people do not have the disease. Okay? Now you do the test on all of them. Let's say this one. So let's say black circle is HIV infected. White circle is not infected. Imagine, and red means the test is positive. Imagine if every single person in the population was positive on this test. What would the sensitivity of this test be? Sensitivity of the test be? Did it pick up all the infected people? Yes. So the sensitivity should be 100. But what's the specificity? Everybody without the disease also were positive on this. So specificity is 0. Okay? So this is a very problematic test. Everybody is lighting up positive on it. Okay? We do not want this situation to happen. Now imagine this. Everybody with the infection lit up as positive. Everybody without the infection had a negative test result. Is this a good test?
Yes.
Absolutely. What would the sensitivity and specificity be? 100 and 100. In reality, I'm afraid, this is what we're going to find. In virtually every case, the test will miss some people with disease, and it will falsely light up as positive in some people without the disease. So the sensitivity will not be 100. The specificity will not be 100. It is our job to then figure out what to do with that information and use it as best as we can in a clinical setting. Okay? Now I'm going to finish off by giving you one example. You know what this is? Ultrasound for what? That's a baby, right? You can see the baby. So you can do something, and when Anika was born, we had that test done, of called a neck fold thickness. Neck fold, okay? The obstetrician or the sonologist will go and compute the amount of thickness of the nuchal fold or a neck fold. And apparently, it's strongly correlated with Down syndrome. Okay, the more the nuchal fold, the greater the risk of Down syndrome. So here's a study done, published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Okay, the numbers are very simple. You can go home and try and compute this if you wish. So there are 28 people with Down syndrome. Can you see that? And how? What's the gold standard for Down syndrome? What's the gold standard? Once the baby is born, you can figure out, you can look at the baby and tell in a few seconds that they have Down syndrome, but you can get a DNA test done and absolutely figure that one out, okay? So there are 28 babies known to have Down syndrome, okay? And now, nuchal fold thickness, positive means it's more than a certain threshold. 21 were positive, 7 were negative. So what's the sensitivity of this test? What's the ratio? How do I get 75%? 21 over 28. So out of the 28 babies with Down syndrome, this ultrasound only picked up 21. Therefore, the sensitivity is 75%. Now, let's look at kids without Down syndrome. Healthy children, okay? 192. The neck fold test came out positive in 4. What are these 4 called? False positives. Okay, so the specificity is 188 or 192 gives you a specificity of 98%. Okay, so which is better, sensitivity or specificity? Which is higher? Specificity is higher. So this is also not a bad situation to be in. So long as one of them is very good, we can still get that test to work in practice. We can sometimes use the test purely to rule out a disease. Okay, and that's a very, very good test sometimes. Half the time, we just want to exclude something. We want to make sure you don't have Alzheimer's. We want to make sure you don't have MS. Okay, those tests are equally good as the ones that we need to rule in. Okay, and using the sensitivity and specificity, we can easily compute something called likelihood ratios. I don't want you to worry about it, but I'm just illustrating to tell you that everything you need comes from the single 2x2 table. Okay, now, here is a scenario. This is very easy for you to understand. I need you to now start thinking that with this test result in mind, we need to start interpreting this nuchal fold. Imagine, put yourself in the position of an obstetrician. Okay? A lot depends on where you practice and what your clientele is. Okay? Because you need to start interpreting these neck fold ultrasound results in the context of the patient who's presenting to you. So, Mrs. B is a 20-year-old woman. Now, tell me when the risk of Down syndrome goes up. When the mom's age is what? About 40. Yes? So 20 means, is she high risk? Low risk. So you see, that 20 years is already a diagnostic test. It has information in it. Heck of a lot of information, actually. And you need to start using it in that context. You just can't randomly do a test and then apply it or interpret it. So 20-year-old woman with the previous normal pregnancy. Is that useful information? Yes. Absolutely. Now I have two pieces of information. All this is the Bayesian process that I'm talking to you about. Who are you? What's your age? What's your context? Everything is adding up cumulatively, okay? And then she's seen in a community hospital. Can you give me a community hospital here where there are low-risk deliveries happening? St. Mary's. So this is St. Mary's. So I'm in St. Mary's. You are a 20-year-old. You already had a normal delivery in the past. Your likelihood of Down syndrome is very, very low. Agreed? So the pretest probability is low. Now, if the neck fold test were positive, what would you do? Would you tell the mom, you know what? You have your baby has Down syndrome? You can't. You know why? Because the pretest probability is so low that even this test, as good as it is, will not push you to a level where you would tell the mom, you know what? You have Down syndrome. At best, you can say, you know what? I'm confused. Because your risk profile, you really should not have this positive test. It could well be that this test is false positive. Let me now do another test on you. Can that happen? That's a negotiation or discussion that needs to happen. You can't be alarmist in this particular woman because the pretest probability is very low. Okay? And the neck fold test is not perfect. That's a discussion that needs to happen. Now imagine this situation. Absolutely common. 37-year-old woman with the previous affected pregnancy. She already had a Down baby in the past. She's 37 years old, and she's at the Royal Vic. Boy, oh boy, this is really high risk. Agreed? So the pretest probability of Downs is so high, and the neck fold is positive. This is bad news. I cannot see how this cannot really be Downs. Even if there's a small risk of false positivity, the post-test probability will be sky high. Now this requires a completely different series of interventions on the part of the obstetrician. Does that make sense? Yeah. Now, on this mom, if the neck fold is negative, can you tell her to go home and celebrate and be happy? Depends, okay? It may have brought you down on the probability threshold quite a bit, but the post-test probability may still be high. That's worrisome for you. Now you have to enter this negotiation and say, you know what? I cannot absolutely rule it out, but looks like good news. We could do another test to potentially confirm that this is really not Downs. Okay? That is the discussion that happened. So when you look at an ultrasound report, they have a lot of this stuff at the bottom. Okay? They tell you what's the population average of Downs, and they tell you what it will be once this test is positive. There are other tests, by the way. Amniocentesis is another example. It's more invasive. That's why we prefer not to do amniocentesis. That's putting a needle in, okay? That can cause fetal loss as well. So this is how we actually need to interpret the test. We do not interpret it without that context. We interpret it in the context of pretest probability. We understand the test has error, and we account for that in our decision making. Is that okay? That's how your doctor will be thinking about this in their mind. Okay? So the take-home messages for you is that diagnostic tests are super important and can help all of us. And I'm as excited as she are. Maybe not as much, but I am excited, okay? I think they are really important, but please remember, they are not perfect. Okay? This kind of test, I mean, HIV is really an outlier. HIV tests have really reached an extraordinary high level of accuracy. But there aren't many other situations where that's the case. I also need you to go home and absolutely think of diagnostic and screening tests as being completely different. Okay? In a screening environment, most people will not have the disease. So your pretest probability is very, very low, and every test will produce false positive results in that setting. Doctors and patients, we all have to understand the inherent error in every test or technology that we use. Okay? Tests should always be interpreted in context, and you just saw one in action. And most importantly, tests should be avoided unless there is a very clear indication. You know, you go to countries like India, or US for that matter, they just push you through a scanner, whole body scanner for $100. What the hell is that? What is the indication for that? Why would anyone push themselves through a whole body scanner? When you do a test when it's not indicated, you're looking for trouble. Trust me, you will find something that you cannot explain after that, and that will lead to lots of invasive testing and add to the cost and the headaches. So a good doctor should know when not to order a test. Right? If I started testing everybody with 2 days of cough for influenza, I'm just going to dig myself into a big hole. Okay? Art of medicine is in trying to figure out when not to test someone. And when you test really low-risk people, for diseases that are not prevalent, you get results that are nightmare to interpret. I know healthcare workers in Montreal, we have hardly any tuberculosis in Montreal, okay? But yet, every doctor in Montreal needs a TB skin test. And go figure out how much confusion that's creating here. And you're saying, what the heck are we doing? There's no TB here. And everybody is getting poked for a skin test. They come running to you. Say, doc, what is this? Right? And we have to sit and explain to them what this is. Could this be a true positive, a false positive? Huge headaches. Okay? So never test when you really don't need it. So we are very, very grateful, Nikki and I, to Jim and our department, Dean Fuchs, Dean Eidelman, the Minimed team, who's been fantastic, keeping us on the ball, so to speak. And, of course, we are thrilled to be doing this to celebrate our department's 50th anniversary. Thank you.
All right. Two really wonderful lectures. And stay calm. First, start thinking of questions. Write them down. And I'll tell you later in a couple of minutes what to do with them. But we have a treat before that. It's not often that the dean has a chance to attend lectures of this kind. He's usually busy with meetings in the evening. So we're very fortunate that Dean David Eidelman is with us. Dr. Eidelman is the Vice Principal of Health Affairs. He's a native Montrealer. He's sitting in a seat he used to sit in as a medical student in this amphitheater. He graduated in 1979 from this medical school. A pulmonary physician, worked clinically, had a research lab at the Meekins Christie, and now he's coming to our lecture. So, David, we're delighted to have you here.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Abe. It is really a great pleasure to be here. Abe is correct. I usually spend my evenings either answering emails or attending boring meetings, and it's great fun to come to a mini-med lecture. I haven't been to one in a long time. It's also particularly great fun to be here for Doctors Pai, who are two of the most exciting members of our faculty, and as you can see, great show people as well. I was not going to use Bollywood. I'm actually a Bollywood fan, and there was no music, so it's not Bollywood. I'm sorry. No, none of this. This was serious stuff. I don't think I ever saw a better explanation of sensitivity, specificity, and likelihood ratios done than I just saw just now. Of course, the other reason why I'm delighted to be here is because this is the 50th anniversary of the Department of Epidemiology, Biostatistics, and Occupational Health. Some of you, it has a very long name, but it also has a very strong reputation, and I don't know how many of you realize really quite how distinguished and well-known this department is in the world. It is, all my departments claim they're the best department. EPI actually has a shot at it. They are probably, if not the best, among the best, but tonight they're for sure the best. And we're very, very proud in the Faculty of Medicine of all of the accomplishments of the extraordinary members of that department. When we came in, there was a running pictures and names of the members of the department, numerous ones, many of whom have made exceptional contributions to science and continue to make great contributions to our education. And finally, I'm delighted to be here, but I guess it should be a little sad because this is the last mini-med in this series. And many people already thanked Ibi and Cappy and others, but I am told on good authority that this is Cappy's last, very, 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 very last, final, not to be repeated, mini-med lecture. So I want to particularly, he looks very, very happy to me this, I want to particularly thank Cappy, who's been instrumental in that. And I just want to say how great it is to come to a cool lecture like this. So without further ado, I'm going to turn you back to my former boss, former Dean Fuchs.
Wonderful. David, thank you again for being with us. It's wonderful to get the support and the connection with the faculty. So write down your questions on a card. We have these wonderful young men and women in red McGill shirts. They're volunteers, students in our faculty. They'll bring the questions down. I will direct them to the speakers. I'm just trying to do this in the interest of getting questions with a high specificity. So, Ah, okay. So, somebody was intrigued, Nikki, about, with this gizmo. Oh. Wants to know, where do you put it? I didn't make up the... I'm just reading them. Anyway, how does it work? What do you do? Is it saliva? Is it fluids? Is it blood? How does this little gizmo work?
Sorry about that. This is a CD4 point of care test. So as we know, when you get a patient positive with an HIV screening test, he or she needs to be staged as to what stage that patient is. Is he in his early HIV? Does he have earlier acute HIV, chronic HIV? And for that, you need CD4 counts. So this is, there are two kinds of point of care CD4. This just shows that it is above and below a threshold. So at 350 and below, the WHO recommends that you need to start treatment. So this is one that just shows that the threshold of 350. And if 350 and if you get a positive line, it just shows that you need to start initiating treatment.
Blood.
No, it's a blood-based test. So it's you take a finger stick sample. There is a very beautiful way of taking this finger stick sample. You take this finger stick sample and stick it in this little well, and then you get the result in 20 to 30 minutes. And these finger stick samples have been found to be as good as phlebotomy samples. And these tests have become very popular now. They're moving into viral load tests like these that can actually help you pick up viral loads also in 20 to 30 minutes. So it's not to be worn, but it is to be used at point of care.
Thank you, it's your husband's turn. So, the question is an interesting one. How do you evaluate a diagnostic test for a condition that's difficult to diagnose? In other words, there's no gold standard.
That's a fantastic question. It's one that we struggle with every day in diagnostic research. And there are many, many conditions for which there is no gold standard. What is the gold standard for depression? Very difficult one. Appendicitis? Half the time we know it's appendicitis only in the operating room. Okay? So there is a probability that even that can be missed. So lots of diseases. Childhood tuberculosis. Nightmare to diagnose. Half the time we have no idea what we're doing. Okay? So in that situation, we use what we call a composite gold standard. We use multiple tests, string them together, and hope that that will be the closest we can come to the truth. There is another situation. Sometimes we just have to wait over time and see whether people get worse or not, and then use that follow-up data to figure out whether they really had that disease or not. Okay? So complicated. And the biostatistical approaches that our department folks use called latent class models. So it's a complex area, but I'll just tell you that it's a fantastic question. It's a problem that we struggle with all the time.
So there are a lot of ramifications. Before we get to the next question, please remember to fill out the forms. There are two forms tonight, the evaluation form for tonight's lecture and the overall evaluation form for the series. We really need feedback data. We live with data. And your feedback is of high sensitivity and high specificity. So we really do want to collect it. I know it's an extra burden before you leave, but we really treasure your feedback. And if there's questions that we can't answer tonight, we'll try and answer some on the web, right? We still do that. So that's useful. Now, as we adopt multiple testing with digital devices, how do we avoid total hypochondria? It's a very good question.
Very good.
And it gets better, and cultural hysteria.
I don't think I have a clear answer to that. In fact, I was thinking that in the second year of medical school, when we used to read about all these conditions, I used to self-diagnose myself, especially with the DSM-V criteria. You find little elements of like obsessiveness and perfectionism and stuff like that. So we as physicians also end up diagnosing ourselves and become hypochondriacs at some point. Until when you start seeing patients and say, okay, no, this is not. I think. It's a brilliant question. It could happen, but at the same time, as we know, that most of these wearable devices, as you can see as of now, they are mostly screening devices. They are all targeting a very niche market. I think your son-in-law will have a clear answer as to which market they're going to target. But in the future, we will have a way of sorting out what data would be used for wellness and what data would be used for prognosis and what data would be used for personalized medicine. In fact, in Toronto, there is a group that has developed a point-of-care test that can actually triage prospective, you know, patients that are appearing with a cardiac arrest as to whether they need invasive, whether they need catheterization or not. They test for a genetic condition, which is only present in the Caucasian population. They test for a gene that is homozygous, and when they find that test to be positive, they actually triage patients and take them in for catheterization. So there are going to be a variety of tests. There will be use and abuse of tests, but as our society evolves, I think we will get to the point where we will have the wisdom to sort between hypochondria, normal diagnosis, screening, and complete hysteria. So it'll be a spectrum, and I admit, like all tests that are not perfect, and as humans we are not perfect, we will get to that. I hope that answers your question.
The doctor's job is to do a test to rule out hypochondria by talking to patients. So it's also a diagnostic test, right? Okay, can the DNA of a fetus be extracted to test for Down syndrome?
Can
the
DNA from the fetus be extracted to test for Down syndrome?
Yes.
I mean, it is possible to do a fetal blood sampling, but it's invasive. So it's it's a difficult one. There's a risk of fetal loss, but it's possible.
And that's why this test is so valuable, because it's easy to do, no risk for mother or fetus, and you would only do the more invasive tests if this one, as Dr. Fai said, is in depth. Now, how accurate and precise? So one question is, if it's easy to make a mistake, why are people inventing these technologies which lead to mistakes?
Oh. You want to go?
I mean, we do need information, and we can't wait for the perfect one to arrive, right? We have to make decisions today in clinic, at homes. So we make do with the best technologies we have today. And the art is to fine-tune them and make them more and more accurate, which is already happening.
Right.
So the first generation Fitbit, the second generation Fitbit, and the most advanced one will all be slightly better or improved before.
Okay. To add, we all make mistakes. I was a surgeon in my past life, and the mantra was, if in doubt, cut it out. So we all make, we've made mistakes as physicians. We make mistakes as biostatisticians. We make mistakes as epidemiologists. We have to be, and I think Rebecca would agree to that, we've made mistakes. We've made, there have been spurious associations. There have been hyped up, instances reported in the media. I think we need to be humble, and we need to be honest about the mission of science. As long as we are humble and we don't fantasize about science, we don't, market it, we are just talking about, this is data. Yes, these are the devices. But yes, like when we develop devices, we always test them. So the strategy that we developed, we tested it out using a sensitivity, specificity, and an impact rubric. And then we said that, it works. So we have to have this, that rigorous approach to evaluating wearable technologies also. And I think that time has come. So once we do that, we will be able to say that it works and it does not work.
Even investors make mistakes. So there's someone in the audience who's an investor, wants to know, what company manufactures these gizmos?
So many.
Are they publicly listed? What's the current price at 4 o'clock today? Anyhow, I guess the answer is many companies.
Yes, yes.
Our slides give credit to all of the innovations.
So there is no single company, but many of them are in the business. And all you do is Google diagnostic tests, and you'll get a huge raft of them. But not all of them are good. So be careful. If diagnostics seek to find the cause of illness, why do doctors use treatments that treat the symptoms and not the cause? Good question.
Sometimes that's exactly what doctors do. They do not want to test, they'll give you something, and they'll hope it'll go away. And most of the time, that's all you need in medicine. Most illnesses are self-limiting. They're going to go away. Okay, so there's no point in wasting money and effort trying to diagnose something if the treatment is still going to be still the same paracetamol at the end of the day. Okay, so most acute fevers, what are you going to do? Right, take a Tylenol, go home and sleep, and you will recover. So there's no point in testing. We test only if the test will materially influence our treatment, or if it's serious enough to warrant something really drastic like a hospitalization or surgery or so on and so forth. Right? So that's a good question, and that's how we practice.
So one individual wants to know whether these gizmos that Nikki showed, are they one-time gizmos? Can they be reused? Can you sterilize them? How do they work in the field, let's say in India in particular?
Right.
How do you manage that?
Like, I don't think you need to sterilize a Fitbit. This is a real-time, you know, real-time monitoring device. The wearable technologies, they also have sensors inside them. And then it's important to keep them close to your heart and close to your heart and close to your heart at the same time because they can pick up the signal and you can get erroneous signals too. So there is a little bit of the learning curve that most of these companies that are startups that have started out and that are learning. I think for many of these screening devices, these are actually now so popular that iWatch has evolved, and I don't think you need to sterilize your watch, but though I do worry about the Swiss watch companies. I don't know what's going to happen to them. If everybody switches to the iWatches, what's going to happen to the Tags and the Omegas and the Tissos? So there's going to be a little bit of a transition. Most of these currently, I think, companies really have no clue as to what they're going to do with all the big data that's going to be generated. And that, I think, is the bigger concern that we should have. And confidentiality of data is important. How it's going to be used and abused is important. We have a lot of data on our personal lives on Facebook. We have data on LinkedIn. We have our own, you know, personal bank account data available to the banks. So a lot of this data is going to be all publicly available. I think that is something that we need to have a public discourse as to how it's going to be used and abused, and how it's going to be if it is going to be monetized, how it's going to be monetized, and what business models are going on in the heads of these developers. So those are the questions that people are still figuring out. I don't think there's a clear answer. But that is the bigger challenge, not sterilization of these devices, because they are supposed to be foolproof. They have sensors in them. Thanks.
Thank you. Somebody in the audience heard Dr. Pai, one of you, talk at a women's health group about the global health crisis and its influence on women. And so what is the impact, particularly on women in developing countries, of the advent of diagnostic test methodology? How does it help? Does it have a specific effect?
Good question. So maybe in the next year, by the end of next year, if there's another mini-med, I would have a follow-up to the study. I think there are lots of groups that are looking at rapid point-of-care diagnostics in helping stage women in rural areas who do not, you know, women who do not get screened for anemia, for basic infections early on, and who end up delivering with HIV-positive infants or go into postpartum hemorrhage or, end up with conditions that should not be there. So there is this hiatus between the developed and the developing world. We have so much of knowledge. We need to apply knowledge. The time has come to stop talking about, you know, this is what we should do, but we need to just trickle it down and make sure that every group, every vulnerable group, or every marginalized group gets to benefit from all this knowledge. That is where, there's something better than science. There is science with a moral compass. So that's where science will achieve its true end, get some social equity in the population. And I'm quoting Bill Feige here. So in terms of really using it for rural women, there's a lot of programs that are going on. Hopkins is also involved in a lot of program for screening for mental health, screening for infectious, communicable conditions. And a lot of these devices are being used to generate this real-time data to impact clinical decision-making.
Thank you. for Kathy Flanders tonight. Would there be a mini-med focused on biology or biochemistry? There may be interest, but we'll need another group to organize. If you're really interested, send in emails, go on the picket lines, whatever. But tonight, however, is the last in the mini epidemiology series. So thanks to Kathy and the team who has worked so hard to put it together, the members of the department, Jim Hanley, Gilles Paradis, Rebecca Fuhrer. Thanks to the faculty for support. And most of all, thank you all for being here, for participating, for your enthusiasm, your questions. Safe travel home, safe winter, and send us your questions and requests. Thank you all.